Judiciary Committee to order here. We will open with a work session for introduction of measures. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I have one measure. Is that all I'm supposed to have?
I think that's it. That's all I have.
All right. I've got, I move that LC 2481 be introduced as a committee bill.
Senator Beyer has moved LC 2481 be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Okay, now we will, we're going a little out of order, folks. We're going to start off with Senate Bill 110 so that we've got some witnesses who need to get out of here. So I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 110. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 110 permits the Attorney General to identify charitable organizations that have annual revenues of $100,000 or more, but that, averaged over a three-year period, spend less than 25% of their annual revenues on, quote, charitable program services, end quote. The bill defines charitable program services to mean the provision of goods or services that promote or fulfill the charitable purposes for which the charitable corporation was formed, but not including fundraising, administrative, or organizational activities. The bill requires the Attorney General to report any charitable organization that violates the bill, also known as disqualified charities, to the Department of Revenue, so long as the organization has been in existence for at least 4 years and has not been included on a report more than once in the last 3 years. The bill allows disqualified charities to ask the Attorney General once a year to review the decision to report the charity. The bill requires the department to include a listing of all disqualified charitable corporations in the personal income tax return instructions and corporate excise tax instructions. The bill provides that contributions to disqualified charities must be added back to federal taxable income for state tax purposes.
Thank you. We're going to start out with Elizabeth Grant and Fred Boss from Department of Justice to present this bill.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. My name is Elizabeth Grant. I'm the attorney in charge of the charitable activities section at the Department of Justice, and I'm here in support of Senate Bill number 110. I think I'd like to begin by, I understand there's a lot of concerns about who the intended target of this proposed legislation is. And I'd like to talk a little bit about, maybe first talk about who we don't intend to target and who might be exempted through appropriate amendments. And I think those amendments that we would recommend would be to exempt community foundations and private foundations and organizations that do not receive a substantial percentage of their revenues.
If I could interrupt you just briefly, I think it'd be most helpful if you could say what the bill does and then talk about who you were.
Okay. Yes, this bill would allow the Attorney General's office to review the financial reports that are already filed with our office and to list those organizations that fail to spend 25% of their expenditures on charitable programs, services. And once we list those organizations, we would turn that list over to the Department of Revenue, and those organizations would be deemed not deductible for public donations on Oregon income tax. And so we would establish a list of charities that are disqualified to receive tax-deductible donations in Oregon. And our intent is to focus on organizations that we believe are sort of misusing or taking advantage of their charitable purpose. And these organizations spend very little money on charitable activity. To give you an example of these types of organizations, it's not uncommon for some organizations to have a contract with a professional telemarketer in which they would receive, the telemarketer would receive 80 to 90% of the donation. That would leave 10% for the organization, and perhaps 5% of that would be used to pay for management salaries, and then maybe another 5% would be actually given to the the charitable purpose that was described to the public. Say, for example, if it's an organization that promotes that it helps disabled children, ultimately only 5% of the public's donation is used in support of the purposes described in the solicitation. So we think that we think that it's not really appropriate to encourage the subsidization of those types of organizations through the tax structure, and we think that by making them disqualified to receive donations or tax-deductible donations, that would help in terms of remedying this problem and also help the donating public to identify those charities that are not really performing as efficiently as the public would expect. So I hope if that gives some sufficient background on the types of charities that we're trying to target and who we're really after. And then I think that through the amendment process, we could clarify and exempt out those types of organizations that would not be impacted and not intended to be impacted by this legislation. And I think that would include private foundations and community foundations. And organizations that, by and large, don't receive a lot of money from tax-deductible donations. And I think that would help clarify that. And I think that, you know, once people sort of understand the targeted group here and that there are a few organizations, most charitable organizations are doing a pretty good job, but there's a few organizations that are really taking advantage of the support of charitable organizations in the state and are using it to sort of pad their own pockets and not to spend monies appropriately on the programs that they describe in their solicitations.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Mr. Boss, did you want to say anything?
Fred Boss of Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice, for the record. The charitable activity section is one of the sections within my division, and I am here to assist in answering any questions that the committee may have.
We've got two bills from you today, so we will have you here as a resource. Any questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Clint Bentz.
You can step down. We got a couple more witnesses. We may have you back up again. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, and members of the committee. My name is Clint Bentz, and I'm a local CPA. I've got significant experience working with the nonprofit community and including many clients who are required currently to report to the Department of Justice. This bill came to my attention from two of my clients, the Oregon State Sheriff's Association and the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, who strongly opposed this bill. And they asked me to review it and to come in and testify. I understand the department feeling that there's some issues maybe that could be corrected in this bill. I have an argument with the bill as it stands that I don't think can be amended away. First of all, I mean, they are defining some new terms. They don't have any reference in the statutes, in the codes, in Internal Revenue or any place else. And there's nothing in the statute that gives the that gives some boundaries for the department. The department basically decide to define these terms however they would like to by rule, because there is no definition for these terms anywhere else in statute. We're putting into law an additional requirement that nonprofit organizations are not considered nonprofit organizations if they don't spend at least 25% of their revenues on charitable program services. Now, there's lots of organizations that this could impact. You know, the Salvation Army received a huge grant. Over a three-year period, are they going to be able to spend all that money, or 25% of it even? I mean, there's lots of organizations that could get drug into this. Girl Scouts, other organizations, charitable remainder trusts, things like that, that by their very nature, if an organization receives a large grant, decides to put it into an endowed fund, that's going to be counted in their annual revenues and will screw up this test, and they'll be disqualified for Oregon receiving tax-deductible contributions. Also, I was concerned, again, about exempting out. There's some language in this bill that basically allows the department to not only use the reports that are given to them, but any other additional information which would drag in a bunch of other entities right now that are exempted from reporting. And my concern, if this bill was enacted, was that there not be that this applies only to organizations that are currently regulated, and this language doesn't allow the department to throw the net broader and bring in other folks that are currently not regulated under the department. Finally, I just don't believe that the public is served by creating a separate set of rules for Oregon nonprofits that are different from the federal code. These requirements not only affect Oregon charities, they're going to impact national charities that are working here in Oregon. The Department of Justice currently is receiving detailed reports from all these charities, including their federal 990s, audited financial statements. They have the ability to investigate whatever they want. They have the ability to publish this information on their website, to put it in the paper, and in fact, they do that. If they find charities that they don't like, that they feel are not serving the public interest, they have the power to shame them, and in fact, they are doing that. I don't know that it is necessary for this committee to give them also the power to, in fact, disqualify them as public charities when, in fact, they do qualify under the federal nonprofit statutes as charities. So, I mean, if we don't like telemarketing, let's deal with telemarketing, but let's not disqualify charities who are otherwise acting in accordance with all the rules. There's a companion bill to this, Senate Bill 109. I have to leave, but with your permission, I've included some comments that I have testifying against that bill.
I think you'll have time. We got the
okay,
information.
If we've got some time
to
discuss
that,
next. Putting these two bills together, it's a really horrible result. I don't like either one of them, and together I really, really don't like them. So, in any case, I think this is a solution in search of a problem, and I think there's better ways to solve this problem than this approach.
Senator Walker.
Thank you. Mr. Benz, I have a question for you. Two. The first one is, do I understand from your testimony that if this bill were to pass and a charity was defined as a 501c3 tax-deductible charity under IRS rules, but under Oregon rules, they could be different, and then it would nullify the contribution?
That's basically what they're saying, is that they would have the ability to say, this public charity, which qualifies under IRS, and you gave the money to them, it does not count for Oregon. Even though it would be deductible on your federal return, it's not deductible on your Oregon return. And the only notice requirement here is you publish it in the tax instructions. So when you get your tax form next year, you'll look down the form and say, oh, yeah, these three charities that I gave money to don't qualify.
Well,
so,
Madam Chair, if I could follow up. Mr. Benz, I saw that in your testimony, and that's worrisome. I know that there are some organizations that I contribute to that have a statement on there that this does not qualify under 501c3 rules as a tax-deductible contribution.
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying that this bill would just make it happen on a tax return, which, I have a choice mm-hmm. whether I want to make a taxable or non-taxable contribution. Depending on my income, I make that choice. But when you've done it and then you go to file your taxes and find out at the end, that's quite an unpleasant surprise,
yes.
Correct?
I would agree.
Okay, then, Madam Chair, I had one other question.
Please.
I don't know what this word is. I don't even know how to pronounce it, and I know
what... Eliomycinary.
Say it again?
I think it's eliomycinary, I think. Anyway, that's in,
what does it
it's
mean?
In the statute.
Yeah, I saw
and
that.
Actually, I had to look it up, and it means for the benefit of a charity.
Okay. Well, that's the strangest word. The English language never ceases to amaze me.
But it's the department's word. It is in the dictionary, but yes, it means for the benefit of charity, charitable purpose.
Okay, well, good.
Yes.
I love language. I love words, and so I've learned a new one today, but I can't pronounce it. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there other questions from the committee? You mentioned that if you got a problem with telemarketing, go after telemarketing, but it's very hard under First Amendment to interfere with anybody's form of speech. Given that constraint, what I think you see what this bill is trying to accomplish is trying to accomplish somebody comes out and says, give, money to this charity and it will be sent to help children in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And then, 2% of it goes to children in Africa and 98% goes somewhere else. As a CPA, do you have any other thoughts on how this can be dealt with?
Well, from my experience, charities find many ways to raise funds, and some charities are using telemarketers to raise funds that are legitimate charities. It's a way to reach an audience of people that don't respond to any other type of solicitation. They don't respond to mail. They don't, and they will respond to a phone call. So I don't have a position for or against the telemarketers. The real issue is the charity doing what they told their clients that they would? And the department currently has the power, again, through the public, through its public voice, through its website, through its connections with the press, to publicize charities that they don't feel are acting in the public interest. They've got the power through the Department of Revenue to report these charities to Internal Revenue if they don't feel like they're behaving according to the, Internal Revenue rules for public charities. So giving the department the power to disqualify charities when the department is not a revenue organization, it doesn't know anything about tax law. It doesn't have those core competencies. That's over in other departments of the state. To give them the power to basically to disqualify a charity based on their perception that charity isn't doing what they think it should be doing, I think is bad policy. I think there's better ways to do this.
Okay. Other questions from the committee? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
We'll get to the next bill in a few minutes here, okay. Nathan, and then we'll let you move along. Terry Pancoast. Welcome, Mr. Pancoast. We've nabbed one of your associates.
And we're very angry about it. But that's not why I'm here.
Okay.
Madam Chair, committee members, I appreciate the opportunity to comment.
Could you identify yourself for the record?
Right. I am Terry Pancoast. I've been an Oregon lawyer since 1968. I represent a lot of charitable organizations of various kinds. I've also served on boards, and I've taught the nonprofit law course at Lewis and Clark College. I'm a partner at Stoll Reeves. That said, I'm here in my capacity as an individual citizen. I'm not representing any of my clients, but simply speaking for myself. Up front, I'd like to say that I have no quarrel at all with reasonable regulation of charities. As a matter of fact, I think that reasonable regulation is positive for legitimate charities. And I also believe that we've got an excellent group in the charitable activities section of the Department of Justice in Oregon. When I talk to colleagues around the country, it's clear to me that they're among the most active and effective that are here. That said, however, I think that this particular bill is misdirected and would actually cause more problems for charities, for donors, and in fact for the Department of Justice itself, then it would solve problems. I've submitted written testimony. It's only three pages, so I hope that everyone will read it. In the interest of time, I'll try to paraphrase and summarize rather than going through everything.
We appreciate that, Mr. Pancoast.
With respect to the need for the legislation at all, and I appreciate the problem that Elizabeth Grant has mentioned. I think they've got already the power to do that. As a matter of fact, I know of at least one case that's going on right now where they're investigating just that, and they have represented that they have the power to take action with respect to it. Interestingly, it's not a case where that would come under the bill because it's a startup organization that's been in existence for less than 4 years. But nevertheless, they seem to think they've got the power already, and I frankly agree with them, both under Oregon statutes and the common law, which gets swept in under the powers of the Attorney General. But even if we assumed, for purposes of the discussion, that additional legislation is necessary, it seems to me that this is really misguided. In the first place, the disqualified charity, there are no direct consequences whatsoever for the disqualified charity if they fail to make these contributions. Instead, the sanction is imposed against innocent donors, and to compound the problem, it's imposed against them retroactively. If I make a contribution this year, I don't even know until I get my tax return in 2008 that it's been listed as a disqualified charity. I just think I don't understand why we would, in an attempt to regulate what charitable organizations are doing, would impose the only sanctions under the bill on innocent donors. It makes no sense whatsoever to me. Senate Bill 110 doesn't distinguish between kinds of charities. I appreciate Elizabeth Grant's comment that amendments could take care of that. It sounded to me from what she was saying that the amendments would virtually exempt almost all organizations. And if that's the case, why was it written this way in the first place, and why can't we instead have a much more narrowly crafted piece of legislation that goes after the problem instead of sweeping in all charitable organizations of all kinds, whether they're grant-making foundations, museums, educational institutions, performing arts organizations, social service agencies, that all come under this. And I agree with the last speaker that that there are circumstances, particularly with those who get a large grant that's restricted to endowment, that could be swept into this legislation as it is, even if they're not in the exempted categories that Ms. Grant would have amended, that would be swept in and lose their exemption. And it seems to me that these are organizations that we all would concede are legitimate charities that are benefiting the public in Oregon. Since she's said that she thinks that that community foundations should be exempted, I'll pass on that part. I trust that the committee would take that advice, but it's particularly an acute problem for grant-making foundations of all kinds. Senate Bill 110 also, to me, inexplicably applies to charitable corporations, but it does not apply to charitable trusts. It's amending the Charitable Trust Corporation Act, which applies to both, but doesn't apply. This legislation applies only to corporations. So we have a situation where, for example, the Meyer Memorial Trust in Portland, which is organized as a trust, would not be subject to the legislation, but the Ford Family Foundation in Roseburg, which has similar assets and similar purposes, would be subject to it. It seems to me that that's just makes no sense from a policy standpoint. There's also a question of due process. The legislation does not provide for any notice to the charity that's going to be disqualified, any opportunity to explain what the figures are. There are no limits on what the Attorney General can look at. And the categories that are established in the bill are not categories that are on the present tax returns that are filed with both the Internal Revenue Service and with the Department of Justice. How is a charity going to know that it is that it's going to be delisted and have an opportunity to explain figures or information that the Attorney General's office is relying on? Then the terms that are used, echo what the last speaker also said, we have come up with terms that, to the best of my knowledge, are not used anywhere else in Oregon law or in the Internal Revenue Code relating to tax-exempt organizations, and I frankly don't know what several of them mean. And I believe that legislation should be clear enough that we know what revenues are, what the provision of goods and services means. If I pay a scholarship, is that the provision of goods and services? It's not goods by any other means. It's not services by any under any other context in the law. So is paying a scholarship not the provision of goods and services? the language to me is just very, very poorly drafted, and perhaps through amendment it could be clarified. But as it stands, it's a substantial problem, and it's a major departure from the categories that that clients and accountants and lawyers have become familiar with in preparing the tax returns that are filed with the Internal Revenue Service and the reports that are currently being filed with the Oregon Attorney General. Finally, the new requirements, if you read this bill literally and don't amend out all of what Ms. Grant is suggesting, I think would be a burden on the charitable activity section. Much of what they focus on is the areas where the public is the most vulnerable, including professional fundraisers and gaming activity. But if this test is going to apply to all charitable organizations, it seems to me that as a matter of administration, they would have to review every CT-12 that is filed, and there are a lot of them. So with that, that's sort of the broad overview. Again, I ask that my fuller comments be read, and I would be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you for coming to testify. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Final witness on this. Before we call our final witness, Roger Martin, on behalf of the Oregon Catholic Conference, would like to be on record in opposition to this bill in its present form. So we will enter that on the record. And if at the end of this hearing Mr. Martin wants to testify, he can certainly do so. Okay, Ross Day. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For your record, my name is Ross Day. I'm the Director of Legal Affairs at Oregonians in Action. We are a 501c4, and we operate two additional 501c3 organizations, the Oregonians in Action Legal Center and the Oregonians in Action Education Center. I can appreciate the problem that they're trying to address with Senate Bill 110, and I don't disagree that that's a laudable goal, and frankly, I'm not particularly worried that any one of our nonprofit charitable corporations would run afoul of the test in Senate Bill 110. My sole concern is the use of the terms fundraising, administrative, or organizational activities. We're engaged in many different activities. For instance, myself, you see me around here quite a bit lobbying when I work for the C4. Does that constitute an organizational activity, or is that a good or service that we're providing our donors? And so, as I suggest in my letter, which I emailed to you and you've also been handed, I think this is those questions at least certainly can be answered through the creation of clear legislative history. Although I understand that the department is going to suggest amendments, and perhaps maybe the amendments should address those questions. But other than that, we don't really have a position one way or the other on the bill. I just wanted to express our sole concern with Senate Bill 110. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing unless Mr. Martin. Okay, I'm getting shaken now here. Close the hearing on Senate Bill 110 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 109. Elizabeth and Fred. Looks like Fred left.
He's out in the hallway.
30 minutes without him.
Okay. Welcome back.
Thank you, sir. Committee. My name is Elizabeth Grant. I'm the attorney in charge of the charitable activities section at the Department of Justice, and I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 109. This legislation would enable the Department of Justice to set the charitable reporting fees by rule, and they are currently set in the statute.
Those fees are used to fund the Attorney General's charitable oversight program. The charitable activities section does not receive any general fund revenues, and so we rely on the registration and reporting fees that charities pay to pay for that oversight activity. The fee has not been increased in over 20 years, essentially since the program really began in its current form. Enabling us to set fees by rule would provide for greater flexibility and allow us to respond to changes in circumstances. I think an example of one of the advantages of setting the fee by rule, currently the statutory delinquency penalty that's set in the rule is a modest $20, and that fee stays the same regardless of how late a report might be. So it makes it somewhat difficult for us to persuade delinquent filers to turn their materials in on time, because once it's late, they realize that there won't be any additional penalties. So if this legislation were adopted, I believe we would move forward by changing by rule the delinquency fee structure so that it would escalate the longer that a report is overdue, and that would be one advantage. I think that for the time being, we would foresee maintaining the current sliding scale fee structure as it exists for for as long as possible, and we would expect, if need be, if we needed to increase fees at some later date, we would anticipate maintaining the same type of sliding scale structure, and any increase would be modest. I also want to point out that Senate Bill 109 also provides some improved mechanisms for enforcement in this area. Right now, it's difficult if we have an organization, particularly an out-of-state organization, that has failed to file reports. It can be difficult to use the civil penalties or to obtain compliance, and they can continue to solicit in the state. And as the Senate bill would allow an administrative remedy to prevent organizations that fail to report from continuing to solicit until they submitted their reports. So I think all in all, this would, I should also mention that currently the section has some rulemaking authority to set fees with respect to gaming licenses for a separate program. And I think we've demonstrated that we use that rulemaking authority responsibly, and it's not in our intention to increase fees beyond that necessary to maintain the program at its current levels. And if fee increase went into effect, it's always subject to review by the legislature. If I'm happy to answer any other questions, and I want to thank you for letting me testify about this matter.
Next question, Senator Walker.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions. One, I'm troubled by your phrase, for the time being. We would keep those fees at a sliding scale. I just don't feel comfortable about that. I think charities and organizations need to have a little more assurance than that. So that would be the first question I'd ask you to respond to. And then secondly, the Secretary of State shows no mercy for candidates or political action committees who file their contribution and expenditures reports late. And there's a whole scale, a whole matrix of what those fees are charged if it's not filed timely. Have you looked at that fee structure to look at untimely filed reports? Because I think these reports do need to be filed in a timely fashion, but you arbitrarily set it at $1,000.
Chairman Burdick, Senator Walker has asked a question regarding our sliding scale fee system and the delinquency penalties. If I might respond, I may have misspoken. I want to the current sliding scale fee structure, I would expect it to remain in place in its current form at its current amounts for as long as possible. I think we would maintain that same structure even if a modest fee increase were necessary at some date. We would maintain the same structure, and it might amount to perhaps a $5 or $10 increase on average for the charitable organizations. But that's down. I just want to be honest that eventually that might need to happen, but I think it's down the road a ways. The way that the sliding scale is structured, larger organizations pay more, smaller organizations pay less, and it would be our intention to maintain that same sliding scale format. And also with respect to the late filings, I'm not particularly familiar with the Secretary of State's fee structure, but I will look into that. I think that we do have concerns about the extent that a flat $20 delinquency fee encourages timely compliance, and we work very hard to maintain compliance. On the other hand, we have a lot of small organizations that do need a lot of assistance and that are not necessarily familiar with all of the reporting requirements. So we work hard to educate them, and we recognize that any penalty that goes to our office is possibly an amount that isn't going to a charitable purpose. So we try to balance those competing concerns. And I think it's our feeling from knowing the nature of the registrations that we deal with that a gradual incremental increase will help get timely compliance. And if that isn't sufficient in getting compliance, then we will take, we will take more aggressive action to get those reports in, and that we do that. Currently, if an organization doesn't timely file, the maximum penalty is $300. And so I think that we felt that a $1,000 increase was actually a fairly significant increase from the current $300 penalty that exists at this time.
Thank you. Senator Barr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also had some issues, I guess, with some of the phrases you used. In addition to "for the time being," you said twice now, "as long as possible," and "once down the road a ways." And I guess "as long as possible" could be tomorrow. "Down the road a ways," could you give us? Those are pretty subjective terms.
Yes, Senator Burdick, if I may clarify for Senator Beyer what I was intending to say. I certainly wouldn't expect, other than the increase in delinquency penalties, to an increase in this biennium, in the 07-09 term. Right now, roughly, our expenditures and our revenues are in balance. But there are economic circumstances that I think that make it hard to project, project into the future too far. As far as I can see, there's a lot of things that it seems that charitable revenues are stable right now, and so that's why I don't think that there would be a need for an increase. And also, I think that in the event that there was a need for an increase, it would still be subject to legislative review.
I'm sure that has to be the first time I've ever heard of a fee increase bill that they don't actually want a fee increase on it. But a couple other questions very quick. There is no mention of a maximum fee amount in this bill, and normally when we give agencies the ability to set fees by rule, we usually cap it someplace. That's not in this bill anywhere that I've seen. And also, I guess, as a question in context with the bill we just heard prior to this, if you find someone and you then put them closer out of the 25% that's going to charity, so how would those two work together in that arena?
If you could keep your response really short, we'd appreciate it.
I don't think that we would be happy to consider a cap on fee increases, and we could discuss what would be appropriate by amendment. And I don't these are not intended to be companion bills. We do consider them to be separate legislation. They just happen to be scheduled for the same day. But I don't think that the amount of a penalty or a fee increase would really have any impact on the 25%. The figures would just not, are so inconsequential that they wouldn't really have an effect on the expenditure threshold legislation. And we can always, I think there was some discussion of amendments on that issue, and I think that could always be addressed by amendments. I feel that that we could address a lot of the concerns about Senate Bill 110 through the amendment process.
You're talking about 109 now.
Yes, we are talking about 109, and I was, but Senator Byer's question raised questions about its the relationship between 109 and 110.
Okay. Any more questions? Okay. Oh, Council, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Just back to this issue of increases. Section 1, the new number 7, says the department shall ensure that the aggregate amount of fees paid under this section is sufficient to pay the department's expenses in administering, and it has various statutes listed. Do you believe that the current fee structure is sufficient to pay the department's expenses in administering these laws that are listed in number 7?
Senator Burdick, if I might respond to Senator Collinson's.
Yes, please.
Right now, I believe that it is enough, that we are in balance right now, but the administrative or personnel expenses continue to increase, and I can't be sure that there's going to be a commensurate increase in charitable revenues. But right now, we're in equal balance with in terms of revenues and expenses.
Follow up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So right now, your revenues come from these fees. It doesn't come from elsewhere, the department's expense. As I read this, it's saying that that the fees paid under the section is sufficient to pay the department's expenses in administering. And it's right now, the way the process works, that's where the revenue comes in, from the fees, not from the general fund or elsewhere.
Correct. The section does not receive any general fund revenue. All of the revenue is from the registration and reporting fees.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Thank you. I'm going to call Clint Bentz and Ross Day, and also invite Mr. Pankost if he has any comments on this bill as well. I saw you stayed for this hearing and wanted to give you an opportunity. You're not signed up, but you're welcome to come up if you'd like. Back.
Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Bentz, start because he has to go.
Thank you, Senator Burnick, Chair Burnick, and members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Clint Bentz. I'm a certified public accountant practicing in the local area. And I oppose Senate Bill 109 on several counts, and I've given some written testimony, and I'll just quickly review what is my testimony is. My biggest problem with this bill, I mean, we're charging fees based on gross revenues, fees based on net assets, giving the department the ability to raise those fees in rule rather than in statute. This has been around for a long time. I don't know if this is a great way to do this, but it's the way we've done it. My concern is that requiring these fees to be established by rule rather than by statute, while it may increase efficiency in government, it does eliminate public input. And if you're a regulated entity and all these fees are going back to regulate you, I mean, basically it's like the sheriff taking his ticket money and sticking it back in to pay gas to put in his car. And that's exactly what's happening here. And if now the fee structure is the fees have to pay for the department's expenses, I mean, in fact, we're just giving the department a blank check to do whatever they want to do, largely outside of the purview of this committee, other committees in the legislature. And while, yes, fees do get reviewed, we all know how that actually works in practice. Unless somebody complains, the fees basically stand. So I believe that there's good reasons to have the Charitable Trust and Corporation Act, the Charitable Solicitations Act. I wasn't aware that the charitable community was picking up the entire cost of that regulation. I assume that there was a general fund component. And if, in fact, these fees have been flat for 20 years, my guess is maybe the department has had extra money to do other things with out of this, and maybe they're running out. Now, I don't know, but my concern is that if these fees going up, that's not a great thing to do.
Thank you very much. Other questions from the committee? Comments from Senator Beyer, perhaps?
Let's give them credit. This is a one lean organization. They've run the same budget for 20 years. I wish the rest of
them. Hey, wow, that's great.
We'd be looking at about a $3 billion total fund budget if that was the case.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's see, where we go next? Let's go to Mr. Day here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, for your record, Ross Day with Oregonians in Action. Of course, we don't want to have our fees raised. I don't think anyone does. But I'm going to offer a little bit different perspective as a 501, representing the two 501c3s that we have. I appreciate what the charitable enforcement review department does, because it makes our lives easier when we're fundraising, frankly, because it keeps the bad seeds, if you will, from poisoning the well for the rest of us. Not that I necessarily want to see our fees raised, but to the extent that they're able to do it by rule, I would strongly suggest that you change the bill just so that you give them the authority to adopt a fee schedule. Because as I read the bill right now, theoretically at least, they could set a fee for each individual charity. And I understand that's not the intent of the bill, and conversations with council understand that's not the intent of the department's intent bringing this bill forward. But I think at a minimum, you should at least make it clear that that they adopt a fee schedule similar to the one that's in statute. Otherwise, we don't really necessarily have a position one way or the other than we don't want to have our fees raised. But other than that.
And as far as input, it's my understanding that with rulemaking, there's also opportunities for public input. Would you feel comfortable with that type of opportunity for public input, short of having a statutory?
Certainly. I guess the way I read the bill, there is a cap on the amount of money they can charge. They can only raise fees to the extent that they need to cover their expenses to run the program. And so I think if they were to overreach and start charging OIA $1 million, that we could probably successfully challenge that rule if we needed to, because it would probably go well over what they need. So yes, I mean, I do feel comfortable with that administrative rule process, not only promulgating it, but the challenge process as well.
Okay, thank you. Senator Cruz?
Yeah, Ms. Day, I guess my question there would be, what's the basis for determining their cost? Mm-hmm. And quite simply, if you said, and that's one of my issues with the bill, it just says raise the fees to cover costs. Well, does that, I see a menu for mischief in something like that. So I appreciate that you're defending integrity, and I don't mean to besmirch it, but.
I think Senator Cruz, Senator Beyer raised a very good point, and that is that traditionally when we see things like this, there is an arbitrary cap on there.
Mm-hmm.
There certainly is in ones that I've seen. So that's definitely a way to go. Are there other questions or comments from the committee?
Just one, Madam Chair. I haven't heard anyone address this. The Secretary of State penalties for delinquent C&E filers, I mean, it's appropriate that it be set, but it's based on how much money you've raised and how much money you've spent. So, and each day you're late, then you get assessed a penalty. Would you see that as being more appropriate than some arbitrary $1,000 cap for all charities? Because some of these charities don't raise a lot of money. Would you agree?
Okay. Would you put that on the record?
Yeah, you're just nodding, and we need an audible answer.
Yes, I agree that...
Any of you can answer.
My name is Clint Vance. I do think having some more definition in the statute about how the penalties are computed and done is appropriate. There are some organizations that $1,000, I mean, is a blink. Others that it would have a significant impact on their operations. And yes, I believe that those penalties should be,
And they basically, they give themselves an out in here saying that if it's unconscionable, and they use that phrase, I think, in that, that they won't charge it, but that's, you know, that's in the eye of the beholder rather than something that somebody could depend on.
Sort of like that word that we can't pronounce.
Yes, yes.
Let me ask for the record the same question I asked Mr. Day, which is, if the right sideboards could be put on and perhaps the right cap and provision for public process, if those things were provided, would you be comfortable with an administrative process as opposed to a statutory process?
Senator Burdick, I have the concern that Senator Cruz raised that, as written, it basically gives the department a blank check to increase the size of the department and require the charities to pay for it. So that's my concern with as it's written. If there was sidebars, I would go along with that if there was a cap and they had limited authority to move the number. In this current bill, there's no sideboards at all.
Because that's a part of the bill that I think I was focused on, which is changing the fee structure from the legislative process to the administrative
yes.
process. And so it's not the process itself. It's the fact that it's too broad.
It's too broad. And I also have a concern that these monies, including the penalties, do go back to the enforcement effort. I just squirm with that. I have a problem with that. I know across the government there are some organizations that this is the way they work. There's others that it doesn't. And my concern is that there would be incentive within the organization to charge penalties and fees to organizations to raise funds for the enforcement there. So that's been in this code for a long time. So the combination of those two things is if I'm a charity and I'm opposing a rule, I would be a little squeamish.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions, comments? Mr. Pankos, did you have anything to add?
Terry Pankos from Stoll Reeves. I certainly have no quarrel with the Department of Justice having sufficient funds to carry out their activities, the charitable activities section of the Department of Justice. I think that I also believe that we could do it through the administrative process rather than legislation. It's probably somewhat more straightforward as long as there's opportunities for input as well as what you've, I think, referred to as sidebars, so that there's some constraints on what they were able to do. I would be comfortable with it. I'm much more frankly concerned about Senate Bill 110 than I am this one. I think this one there are some pretty easy fixes, I believe, with this one.
And how do you feel about the matter of having the fees go to the enforcement effort? Do you see a conflict there?
Well, as a matter of political philosophy, I might not choose that, but that's the way it's been done in the past. I think if we have the appropriate constraints on what can be charged and the standards for how they do it, I think it is fine.
Okay, thank you. Other questions from the committee?
Yes. Madam Chair, I have one more comment. Just both of these bills, both 109 and 110, amend section 128.620, which is a definition section. Some of these definitions are incompatible, and it would depend on which one is done first. So that would be something that need to be cleaned up when these were finally.
Are you a
passed.
Lawyer too?
No, I'm not.
Just a very careful CPA.
Yeah, you are. My commendation here. Okay. Are there other questions from the committee? This has been very helpful. Thank you very much. Okay. We will close the hearing on Senate Bill 109. And move into a hearing on Senate Bill 65. Thank you. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 65 provides that the Attorney General may represent the state or any agency or officer of the state who appears as a lead plaintiff in a class action involving a claim relating to a security, even if the class includes individuals or entities that the Attorney General may not otherwise represent.
Okay, we have Fred Voss. And did you want Kate to come up with you at the same time? Okay.
Yes, sir. Pretty good. Thank you.
I got that one.
Good, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Fred Boss. I am Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. I am here to testify in favor or in support of Senate Bill 65. The Department of Justice is of the opinion that it cannot represent a state fund as a lead plaintiff in a class action lawsuit. My written testimony details the provisions of that analysis, and I won't go into that in detail. Senate Bill 65 provides for a narrow change to Chapter 180 that would allow the Department of Justice to represent a state fund in a class action lawsuit involving a securities loss. Class action lawsuits are often used to obtain recoveries for funds which have lost monies due to security fraud. I do not anticipate that this tool would be used frequently, but it would be useful to ensure an adequate recovery for state funds or to ensure corporate governance changes were made in the corporation. And I would be pleased to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you. Any questions? Ms. Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Kate Cooper Richardson, Chief of Staff for the Office of the State Treasurer. As Mr. Boss has outlined, this is a narrow change to Chapter 180. As the current interpretation is, it's prevented the Attorney General from representing state officers and agencies as lead plaintiffs in class actions related to securities. And this has prevented the Oregon Public Employees Retirement Fund specifically, which is necessarily represented by the Attorney General, from serving as a lead plaintiff in class action securities fraud cases. And this amendment would take care of that and allow that to be a possibility in the future. The fund regularly participates in federal securities class action suits when it suffers losses due to fraud or other security violations. And for those class actions, the court appoints a lead plaintiff to be to represent the members of the class, but Oregon has to date been unable to serve as a lead plaintiff in any of the class actions in which it's been a member. And pension funds from many other states, including California, New York, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Florida, have served as lead plaintiffs in securities class actions. And the state treasurer just believes that Oregon should have that ability to join those states and taking the lead to enforce the securities laws and to keep our national securities markets free of fraud. The Oregon's fund is, as you may know, is one of the largest public institutional investors in the nation, and in some cases may be the best suited in the class to perform the role of lead plaintiff to maximize recovery for the class. So if Oregon can serve as a lead class plaintiff, it'll join a lot of other states in leading this effort to recover pension funds, school funds, and other state funds that have been lost due to fraud. And this will benefit the Public Employees Retirement Fund, as same with Oregon consumers, retirees, and taxpayers. The state would be in a better position to negotiate and monitor attorney fees, to oversee settlement discussions and case strategy, and to negotiate other remedies that would benefit the market, such as corporate governance changes. Right now, Oregon currently has the ability to opt out of these class actions and seek a separate recourse, but we should have the flexibility to act as a lead plaintiff in a particular case if the circumstances warrant and if the court appoints us. The Treasurer sees this as an extension of the Investment Council's requirement to exercise their fiduciary duties, and so we would ask your support for this bill. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. We've had some drafting issues. Is this bill draft? Are you comfortable with the way this is built? The bill is drafted to accomplish what you want today?
We are. Okay.
Chair Burdick, we are.
Madam Chair.
Senator Barr.
Just curious to know if either the witnesses know how I voted last session or the session before or the session before that. I don't remember.
You never, Senator Barr, I can answer that. You never got a chance to vote on it.
Well, we didn't. It was no. It's been in front of this committee every session I've been on the committee, I think.
That's correct.
It never come to vote.
And the person who sat in this seat did not like it.
Well,
That was you.
Madam Chair.
Did it get to the floor?
It did. And it passed. There was only one no vote on the floor of the Senate.
Then I'm confusing it with another. My apologies.
So it did pass. Actually, it was one of the first bills out of this committee, January 20th, 2005, yeah. Actually.
I happened
to look that up. So it made it out of the Senate without a problem, one no vote last session.
And who was that no vote?
It happened to be Senator Schrader for...
I was going to say, that was his no period. Well, early session Schrader's a no. That's just it. So.
Well, I'm glad you cleared up the record. I was clearly mistaking it with another bill. So thank you for clearing that up.
Sure.
Are there any other questions of these witnesses?
Good bill should pass.
Okay. Thank you. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 65 and open a work session on Senate Bill 65. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 65 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved Senate Bill 65 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. I will carry this one. Okay. Now we will open a public hearing on our last bill, which is Senate Bill 79. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 79 provides that information about an elector's disability that is entered into official voter registration records by an election official is exempt from disclosure under Oregon's public record laws.
Hey, Mr. Lindbeck. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is John Lindbeck. I'm Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's office. I have with me at the table Gene Newton from the election staff, who is our staff member who works most closely with all issues dealing with voters with disabilities.
Okay.
This bill is before us today at the request of a subcommittee that we have that advises the Secretary of State's office on issues relating to voting and voters with disabilities, particularly in regards to compliance with the Help America Vote Act of 2002. The Help America Vote Act was the landmark legislation that was passed in reaction to the events of Florida in the year 2000. One of the requirements of the Help America Vote Act is that each state provide a way or means for voters with disabilities to vote privately and independently. And so since the passage of that act, we've been working very hard in the Secretary of State's office with the county clerks on ways in which and services that we can provide to voters with disabilities to achieve that goal. They want to vote privately and independently, just like folks who are able-bodied. One of the issues that has come up and why this has become a concern is that we now also, because of the Help America Vote Act, have a new centralized voter registration system, as some of you may be aware. So voter information about voters is more accessible now than it ever has been. It used to be that you needed to go to each of Oregon's 36 counties to get comprehensive information about voter registration and individual voters, and now you need to just go to one place, either our office or one of the county elections offices, and information about voter registration information, including about individual voters, is freely accessible at any one of those locations because it is public information. There is an interest by the county clerks and the state in order to provide the best level of service to voters with disabilities, in including in the voter registration record that a person has a certain kind of disability and that they request a certain kind of assistance from the state or the county with voting. And it would be very helpful for the administration of elections and to the voters if those records could be held permanently in the centralized voter registration system. The problem is that people with disabilities consider that information to be private. Don't want to have information about a disability, be they blind or paraplegic, something that makes them vulnerable on the record in a public arena like that. What this bill would do is add a clause that says identifying information relating to the disability of an elector that is entered into official voter registration records by an elections official is exempt from disclosure under ORS 192.410 to 192.505. So it would add to the list of items exempt from public disclosure identifying information related to disabilities that is entered into the public system by an elections official. There are good reasons for this. The disabilities folks that we work with believe that they could be potentially put at risk if this information is on the public record. It makes them more vulnerable. It could be potentially embarrassing to them if this is put on the public record. And a good example of that would be that somebody has a serious learning disability, for example, and they cannot read, but they want information that from elections officials that is specifically designed to help them vote. It could have a chilling effect on people's willingness to ask for assistance from election staff if they know that this information is put on the public record and it's available to anybody who just walks into the elections office. And one of the chief benefits of this bill is that it would enable the elections officials to keep a permanent list of people with disabilities so that they don't have to ask each and every election for the same type of assistance over and over again. That information could be put in the voter record, and then the county could automatically provide that assistance with every election. We cannot think of a legitimate public purpose as to why this information should be public, and surveyed the statutes to try and find if any other statute was explicit in covering this kind of information, and we did not find anything with sufficient explicit language that satisfied us that we could keep this information confidential, and that is why we're before you today asking for your support of Senate Bill 79. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I favor the bill. I think it's pretty straightforward. I guess I was wondering if you had any success in looking at what DMV does, because they give out handicap placards, and I'm assuming that those records are not released to the general public based on the non-disclosure they have, as well as I question whether you'd have the authority to do it under HIPAA. With many of these issues being medical oriented, it would seem to me that we may already be prohibited from doing so, and I think if we need to clarify the statute and just put it in there to make sure everyone knows very clearly and rightly, then we'll do that. But it seems to me that this is very straightforward, and for clarification, I support the bill.
Senator Walker.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question because, well, I don't have my notebook, and in my notebook I always carry voter registration cards. It's just a habit. But I don't recall on the voter registration card that there's any place that you check off if you have a disability. Is it on the voter registration card?
Madam Chair, no, Senator Walker, no, there is no place for you to check off and let us know that you have a disability. It's incumbent on the voter to let us know if they want some sort of special service.
Then my question as a follow-up, if I can, Madam Chair, is how do people get that information about a person than if it's, if, because most everything on the voter registration card is public. In fact, one man told me this election cycle that he unregistered because people got his cell phone number and they were calling him. And I said, mm-hmm. Well, did you put it on the voter registration card? And he said, yes. And I said, well, there you go. So, you know, how, I just don't understand how people are getting this information about someone's disability.
How people are getting the information?
Yeah, how would someone get that information? I mean, I support the bill. I just don't understand how they're getting the information.
Because let's say that I was blind, and I called into Marion County and said, I want you to send me a special kind of ballot that Marion County uses to assist people who are blind.
Mm-hmm.
The county keeps a record of that in my voter registration record that I requested that assistance.
I see.
And so it isn't that they report up front when they register, but they will seek assistance from the county, and the counties like to keep records so that that person doesn't have to come back before every single election and ask for that same service over and over again.
Okay. Thank you. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Under subsection 4 of the bill, starting on line 13, it looks like the documentation they submit is already exempt. So what you're trying to do is just expand that and just say the fact of their disability itself would also be exempt, the fact that they're blind or the fact that they're wheelchair bound or something like that.
Correct.
Okay.
Section 4 was adopted with respect to identification information that all voters are now required to provide under the Help America Vote Act in order to be qualified to register or in order to qualify to vote in federal races.
Okay, so that has nothing to do with any disability.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Did you want to say anything?
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Gene Newton, Secretary of State Elections Division. The only thing I would add is that we are, one of the things that we've been doing is adding lots of programs, resources, for example, audio voter guides, large print things that we do for informational purposes, which are making more people aware that we are providing services to people with disabilities, and they are contacting us a lot more and self-disclosing that, you know, I'd really like to have these alternate formats or I'd like this kind of assistance. So that's where we're getting the information.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, other questions? Okay,
Madam Chair, could I add one more thing before I leave?
Sure.
Thank you very much. This would not keep the entire voter's record confidential. Their name and their address and all the stuff that's normally public would continue to be public. Only the fact that they have a disability that's the only part of their voter record that would remain confidential, and I wanted to be clear about that. And it also would not preclude us from providing statistical information to those who might be interested about the number of voters statewide or in a particular county who receive assistance of various kinds because of their disabilities.
To your knowledge, has anyone ever fraudulently signed up as disabled who turned out not to be disabled?
I've not heard of that, no.
Would there be any motivation for anybody to do that you can think of?
I can't think of one particularly because we make it so easy for people to vote in the state with our vote-by-mail system. I can't think of one that at least would be a serious problem.
Okay, thank you. All right, thanks.
Thank you.
Sarah Myers.
Welcome. Thank you. Good afternoon, members of the committee, Chair Burdick. For the record, my name is Sarah Myers. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. With respect to some of the questions that Chair Burdick, you've asked with respect to whether there have been any instances and those kinds of things, those were some of the questions that we raised as to whether or not this information would be harmful or had had been the subject thereof for reasons for which we would need to add a specific exemption in addition to those that are already either in this particular statute under 247 or in addition to Chapter 192 for public records exemptions. And to the question as to whether or not we believe that there is already an exemption in statute
I reviewed Chapter 192.502 sub 2 that relates to, quote, other public records exempt from disclosure, which basically already extends a protection against disclosure for, quote, information of a personal nature, end quote, and places the burden on the requester to demonstrate that disclosing such information for the purpose of serving the public interest is necessary and can be presented through a clear and convincing evidence that in this particular instance. And further, it also puts the burden for the party seeking the disclosure to have, to show that the public disclosure would not constitute an unreasonable invasion of privacy. So to that extent, we do believe that there already is a protection in place under current public records statute, and don't believe that this additional specific exemption is necessary. And as I said, again, we believe that the statute with respect to the voters in terms of electors already, as Mr. Lindbeck pointed out, does present protections, if you will, in place for requesting of information related to the elector, their name, their address. And in cases where an elector would request information be held from disclosure, it also points out that the Secretary of State has to define whether there's a personal safety matter at risk for the person's information being disclosed. So with any other, if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer those to the best of my ability.
Council's looking this up right now, but the 192.410, the citation in this, there's an outright exemption and there's a conditional exemption under the public records law.
192.502 sub 2 speaks to other public records exempt from disclosure.
No, I'm talking about the sections of the public records law. There's an outright exemption section and then there's a conditional exemption section. And we've got counsel looking it up now, but I just wondered if you knew off the top of your head, or maybe Mr. Lindbeck knows.
I'm sorry, I don't.
Need to go back. Madam Chair,
Senator,
while they're doing that, can I just ask a question?
Yes, please.
Just from your testimony, I'm wondering whether or not the Newspaper Association publishers would agree that that the Elections Department or Division does not have to provide the information regarding a person's handicap if a request was made by a newspaper.
Chair Burdick, Senator Pruszanski, I'm sorry, I don't understand the question. So whether currently
if the Oregonian walked in with a request and they wanted to know whether what someone's handicap was as it has been registered with the Department of Secretary of State's Election Division, would the Election Division be required under your interpretation to hand over that information as to what the handicap is of that voter?
I think in the instance, Chair Burdick, Senator Pruszanski, that if we could present the public interest reason for which we would need the information that is publicly available regarding that particular elector, that yes, that information may currently be included as a part of that information if we were able to demonstrate public interest.
Could you give me, if I can follow up, could you give me an example where you think public interest might actually be on the side of the position that the in this case, I'm just using the Oregonian as an example, if they were the ones that put out the request.
I could certainly try, Chair Burdick, Senator Pruszanski, perhaps maybe in the case where we're discussing specific voter turnout related to demographics of, say, blind and or the hearing impaired, and whereby a particular instance, I don't know, maybe a legal instance could come up regarding a particular voter's denial of access to the appropriate measures to vote. I don't have any specific example, I think, that has ever been raised previously regarding that instance, but I could imagine there may be an instance where that information would be relevant to reporting of the public interest regarding the demographic and whether a specific person may or may not have had the access they needed to vote.
One follow-up.
Please follow up.
We've heard from the proponents of the bill that they would still be obligated to give out the demographic information on a percentage as to the number of voters, but
you believe that the newspapers or TV media or whatever source of media should have the ability to go in and specifically ask for an individual voter's handicap as compared to capturing that information regarding that person in a general demographic percentage model or facts that were provided to that organization?
Chair Burdick, Senator Przanski, I believe in the case where, for example, that I raised that if, for example, a specific individual voter was registered and had some sort of a denial during the process by which they were attempting to vote, that that would be a relevant matter that related to their disability and what that might have been and what services or assistance they should have been provided during that process.
If I can follow up, wouldn't you be able to get that information or the paper get that information directly from that who that individual that might be stating that they were denied a waiver or a right to vote as compared to taking it from the public record that's maybe closed for other reasons?
Chair Burdick, Senator Przanski, I suppose that, that could be true, yes.
Thank you.
Well, but that raises another issue. As I read this, and both counsel and I agree that this is an absolute exemption from any coverage by the law. It's not a something that you can appeal by proving the public interest, which other exemptions are appealable. So in a case like this, if the person said they were disabled and they were denied the ability to vote and they didn't get the assistance or whatever and you had reason to question that and they said go ahead and check my voter record, there doesn't seem to be a provision here to have the voter disclose their voter record.
Madam Chair, if I could, they would be able to do that. They can give anyone the authority, authorization to get that information. If they signed the paper that gave that to them, they could go to any organization and say, I'm waiving my rights to privacy, just as you would almost be acting as power of an attorney type of that you're allowing someone to disclose. The same thing with HIPAA in any type of a health area. A patient can waive that right. They have that right to do that. And once they gave it to them, then if, as long as they could verify at the Secretary of State's office that that was a valid signature and waiver in the sense that it's properly filled out, then they would be obligated to provide that information.
Mr. Limbeck, could you come up to and confirm that on the record, please? The question was if it's okay with the voter under this bill, if there's a disabled voter who wants to document their disability status with the elections division, that if they submit something to you in writing authorizing you to release this information, would this give you the authority you need to release the information?
Madam Chair, it's John Limbeck, Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's office. I've never specifically dealt with that kind of situation, but my understanding of how it works is consistent with Senator Przanski's understanding. There's nothing in this bill that would preclude a voter from self-disclosing information about a disability. That's entirely the choice of the voter. We just think that there is an overall public interest in protecting that class of voters, and protecting that information. Self-disclosure on their part—that's their choice. But we don't believe that it should be government that discloses it for them.
Senator Barr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just looking at number four still. That's under current. That is current law, and it seems like this would already be covered by the number four that's there, but maybe the key words there are the submitted by an individual, because I mean we're talking about identifying information, which is I mean this isn't a disability, it could be considered identifying information, but I see below you said entered into the record by an elections official, and is that why you have to do something new, because the elections officials are doing this, not it's not on the voter registration card, somebody calls and you're putting it in the official record, But if you were just to eliminate the word submitted by an individual in number four, could you get the same thing without adding this new language?
Well, it says submitted by an individual for purposes of registering to vote. That whole phrase applies to information that voters under the Help America Vote Act are now required to submit. It's a driver's license number, or if you don't have a driver's license number, the last four digits of your Social Security number that we in turn have to verify in order to qualify the voter to be registered to vote. The information in paragraph 5 is information that is not necessary in order to be registered to vote, but as you correctly stated, Senator Beyer, would be information that an elections official would enter into the record in order to provide a specific voting service to a voter with disability. As to your question as to if we deleted the phrase submitted by an individual, I don't think that would be enough because it would say we would still have the phrase for purposes of registering to vote as required under the Help America Vote Act. I think you're right. We probably could rework paragraph 4 in some way to cover this, but I don't know that that would be, I guess, any more or less work than simply adopting the proposed paragraph 5.
Okay. We're about to lose a committee member. Senator Beyer, do you like this bill?
Oh, I wouldn't mind thinking about it. I guess I'm curious about Senator Pruszynski's questions about HIPAA and the DMV, if there are any corresponding, you know, things there already. So I'd just like to digest a little bit, may get those two questions answered, if nothing else. But
On the DMV, there's that blanket exemption from releasing this information. We did that based on trying to keep people safe from disclosure, from people going in paying $2.50 with a trace on a license plate and getting registered owner information. So what they have, I mean, we could look at it as a model as to how they've done it in the area of transportation, but clearly it would not be one that would cover here. I was just kind of using an example that we've already seen that those steps taken for reasons of trying to protect someone's identity. In this case, it's an extension of that. It's a individual feature, health feature of that individual.
Well, this is more about privacy than identity.
Right.
So did you want to mull this, or are you ready to move on this?
I can report today.
Okay. Close the hearing on Senate Bill 79. Open a work session on Senate Bill 79. Senator Beyer.
Move Senate Bill 79 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved Senate Bill 79 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Walker.
I'm all about public disclosure. I don't like making records secret, as you well know, but this seems pretty straightforward on its face, so I think it's appropriate. Nobody has any business of knowing what disability someone has.
Yeah, and I share your commitment to open records and your other comments. Senator Cruz?
Thank you, Madam Chair. HIPAA's been brought up a couple times, and one can self-disclose, one cannot. Under HIPAA, give permission to disclose outside of systems. I know that. And there may be HIPAA concerns that this would address, quite simply because it becomes protected.
Okay. Any objections? So ordered. Senator Pruszynski, would you like to carry this?
I'd be honored to.
Okay. We're adjourned.